Welcome to lesson 3 in our online permaculture design course. We're experimenting different ways of conveying this body of information, and we want you to really think about it, not to passively observe, but to really engage with the ideas that we're sharing with you. And that's really what permaculture is all about. Now we're going to take you through this cycle of 12 principles, 12 perspectives, shall we say, and which is one way which we're going to give structure to our course. And of course, the other way that we're doing that is we are following the book Small and Slow Solutions, which is produced with the idea of communicating these very, very important ideas about how we live in a creative partnership with the natural world. This is really what we're driving towards. So there's a wonderful icon, David Holmgren, the permaculture co-author, who created these sort of 12 perspectives, a way of sort of making permaculture a bit more memorable, a bit more accessible. He had the wonderful idea of not just having a statement, observe and interact, but also expressing that in the form of an icon or a picture or something that's sort of memorable in its own way. And the icon for principle number one, observe and interact, is a tree or with a hole in it. In this case, with a face in it. This is drawn by one of our students. I kind of like it. It applies community too. If you were to see a tree with a hole in it, you would most likely perhaps want to have a look inside and see what might be there. And we're trying to present this as a way of a way in, a window into thinking about the world slightly differently. So, and then there's a more poetic saying that goes with the principle as well, with the statement and this image. And the saying is, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So think about what that might mean. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It's, in some ways, for me, it's implying it's about how we see things. Often when I teach about this, I give a really simple example of a cow might deposit some manure. And you might look at that and go, ah, yuck, horrible, smelly, flies, problems, you know, and see that as something which is an ugly thing. Whereas perhaps someone else might look at it and think, compost, manure, fertility, something I can, add to my soil, add to my garden. So again, in page 28 of Small and Slow Solutions, I also bring the idea of encouraging us to see nature and to see it from different perspectives and to kind of ask ourselves, what is it that we see when we actively do observe nature? I put in the example here of a grasshopper. When I saw that grasshopper with those amazing colours, I stated, wow, that's so beautiful. That's really stunning. And I wanted to take a photo of it. And the farmer that I was with said, oh, it's a pest. We can't get rid of the stupid things. And then I just imagined something like a large bird, something like a turkey or something coming along and just eating it. And it struck me as beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It's how you see things. So in this unit, in this lesson, this principle, we're going to really be thinking about how we see the world. So it's all about observation. And I like to say this at the beginning of every course is, I'm not asking you to believe anything, okay? I'm not here to sell you something or convince you of something that isn't apparent. And in fact, it's the opposite, is I kind of want you to challenge everything that I say. And not in a blocking way, but in a way in which I want you to go away and test all of these things for yourself. Find out how it is for you. And also don't forget, I'm only coming from my own perspective, which isn't the same as yours. I'm in Wales, in the UK at the moment, as I'm narrating this, and I'm, you know, surrounded by the things that are to do with here. So perhaps the observations that I'm making are slightly different. My perspectives are different. But I'm in permaculture, we're really fascinated. I'm certainly fascinated by these things which are universally true. So the things that we can all agree about without really having to discuss it, because we're all experiencing it the same. So the really obvious one for me is water flows downhill. Okay, unless you add energy, you can pump it uphill, but you've got to do a lot of work to do that. So left to its own devices, because of gravity, when it rains, you know, from the sky to the mountains, flows down into the sea. That's a sort of a hard to argue with observable reality. So organic matter, if you leave it lying on the ground, it will decay and compost to break down into soil again. That seems to be pretty much universal. Plants grow towards the light. We all need to eat. And I added one more, which is that sometimes the most obvious things are, they're so obvious, they're so self-apparent, that they're the hardest things to see. So we're going to also try and sort of take off the, the curtains in front of our eyes or something. Well, I don't know what the right saying would be, but, you know, to try and see the world afresh, try and see it slightly differently. So if you haven't watched it already, I invite you to pause this audio now and watch this little clip. It's only 2 minutes of the amazing physicist Richard Feynman, just talking a little bit about the scientific method. He's just introduced by a current physicist, Brian Cox, who's very famous in the UK. So I invite you to look at that and to consider again this lesson, this idea that I brought to you from the first modules, is the idea of spaceship Earth. It's understanding that we are all actually on some level here together, sharing the same ecosystem, and we're all sort of shaped and governed by universal forces. And no matter what part of the ecosystem you might be in, you're still being, if you like, governed and shaped by these same universal forces. And that's, again, absolutely central to permaculture, trying to understand how the world works, what's the very nature of it, so that we can live much more in harmony with it. Okay, so I invite you to download the PDF, the slideshow of, it's called Principles of Natural Systems. And we're going to start just by analysing an image, a photo on the front. And I took that photo yesterday. It's here we are at the end of April, middle of April, in Wales. And I want to illustrate a point. Is we're looking at the hillside. You can see a little farmhouse at the bottom, surrounded by trees. And that's a very steep slope. And what's happened is a new, young, inexperienced farmer has been given this piece of land. I can't actually imagine how this came about, but this is what happened, and I was just being told about it yesterday. And you can see a line across the middle of the field where a hedgerow has been ripped out along the contour, running almost level. And you can see the scar across the landscape. And then what they did was that the farmer took a plough or a sort of harrow or something, and they sprayed the field so that there were no plants in it. So they killed all the grasses and what have you, exposing the soil to the sunlight. So it dries out, becomes vulnerable. They then ploughed it up and down the hill, creating little gullies and grooves, literally pointing straight down the hill. So then it rained. Guess what happened? The crops, the field, the soil all ended up down on the road. The whole lot was just washed away, because by removing the trees, by removing the hedges, by removing the plants, suddenly the soil is exposed and it's really, really vulnerable. And you just, it's really a perfect illustration of, okay, let me maybe expand also, is to say this, is the uplands of Wales, the hills of Wales where I live, is the soils are very thin and they're very poor and they don't want to grow crops. They're not set up for growing you know, fields of vegetables or wheat and barley or something like that. We can grow grass, we can grow trees, which would be a much better choice. But of course, trees grow very, very slowly and don't give you much of a yield. So the farmer has tried to speed it all up by using technology, by using diesel, by using pesticides. And really what he's done is destroy the landscape because he's broken every rule of how to work with nature. And I just can only hope that he's learned a lot of lessons and will never do anything as stupid as that again. And I hope that in some ways we can already see where we're driving at with permaculture is soil should be always covered. Soil forms under forests. Soil forms under plants. So when it becomes bare, it's incredibly vulnerable. On slopes, when the water comes, when the rain comes, the rain's going to run downhill. It's going to bring the soil with it. It's going to bring the nutrients, wash them out through the soil, and you're going to degrade the whole system. So these are really observations now I'm making in my own landscape, looking at someone who's made some very big mistakes by perhaps not being thoughtful enough. And we'll get further on into permaculture. We'll think about how can we go and fix these things, because I'm also here to tell you that we can look at degraded, destroyed landscapes like that and think there's no coming back. And the answer is there is. There's all sorts of approaches that we can use to restore damaged land. And that's a lot of, again, of what really where we're going with the permaculture concept is. I want to give a very positive message. But again, we're at the beginning of our journey. So I'm saying if you could observe and interact, you can be thoughtful and considerate. You could actually turn problems into solutions. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's get back to the core of this lecture. So if we move to the second slide, there's a quote from Kenneth Balding. He says, "Anyone who believes that exponential growth can go on forever in a finite world is either a madman or an economist." And that is making very, really acerbic statement. But he's pointing out that economy, the money side, the way that we rationalize how we make, you know, decisions about how we use resources, we're always talking about economic growth. It's always more. It's always, we want to increase the capacity. We want to increase the amount of goods and services that are passing through the economy. Well, in a finite world, within the confines of the natural world, we can't keep doing that, especially not if we're going to do it in a way in which our production destroys nature, as we saw in the first picture. So we certainly can't carry on behaving like that. There's a couple of cartoons which I like to show just because they kind of challenge people just to think slightly differently. What you environmentalists have got to understand is that the destruction of the planet may be the price we have to pay for a healthy economy. And again, that's kind of the message that we're told, is that we have to sacrifice the economy because the natural world, we cut the forests, plough the soils, because we need to make money. Because we need a healthy economy. Well, we're trying to challenge that, because in permaculture, we would argue that the natural world is infinite and can go on forever, but only if you operate within its rules. But if you operate within its rules, it keeps on yielding every year. And that's where we need to get. Now, here's another just very simple cartoon is, you know, the guy is offering the truth, but it's unpleasant, it's difficult. Or you just want to hear some comforting lies? You want me to tell you climate change isn't happening? You want to tell me that the number of animal and plant species is collapsing? Isn't, you know? Do you want me to tell you that everything's fine? The economy can grow forever? I'm sorry, none of those things are true. That doesn't mean we can't do anything about it, and it doesn't mean we can't fix it. So again, that first slide of that destroyed field is, we're going to think about how we can fix things like that using natural processes. Okay, I like this next slide. I like this picture a lot. I've used this over several years. It's a lumberjack, a forester, a man who cuts down trees for his living, and you know, his check shirt and his big axe and his macho beard. And he's contemplating cutting off his own foot. Think about that. The forest, the soil, the plants, the birds, the air, the water, they're all interconnected. They're all part of an interconnected ecosystem. They're not separate, not there just to be harvested without there being consequences. So the idea of a forester with his big axe contemplating cutting off his own foot to make his living is a very powerful and kind of truthful image. So again, I want to take that on board and think about what that means. Okay, here's the same kind of thing expressed in a graph. Okay, only goes up to even before 2000, goes up to 25 years ago. But if you think about, we've talked about climate change. You saw the Neil deGrasse Tyson video, I think, in the previous lecture. There's a certain amount of energy coming into the planet every year from the sun. That's the only new energy that's coming in. That's the only new input that we've got into our otherwise closed planetary system is the solar energy, okay? So as long as we can live off the plants that we can grow and the warmth and the what have you from that solar energy, then we can be sustainable. We can carry on and be here forever. But at some point in the 1980s, our industrial, consumerist, Western-led sort of lifestyle got to the point where it was consuming more energy every year than it was actually coming in, you know, new energy coming in. And so the question is, what happens when you do that? What happens when you take more out of a system than it's been put in? Obviously, you deplete it. You erode into it. It becomes less stable. It becomes less strong because you're every year taking out more than you're putting in that is coming in. And that's the very nature of the unsustainable way that we are currently living. And this is the transition that we have to make and the journey that we're on. So, moving on. I want to explore ecological principles. I want to explore this idea with you that if we want to be sustainable, we want to live in harmony with nature, we want to be to find a way to be regenerative and restorative, not just being benign, but actually to add a net benefit, is actually that's what nature does all the time. And what I'm really inviting you to do now is to try and see nature itself. There's natural processes that are going on around us all the time as your teacher. The natural world is your classroom. Okay? So, and this very grand-looking gentleman, next slide, sat on his, this is a statue in the town of Shrewsbury in Shropshire. A very famous gentleman he is too, who's Charles Darwin, who just over 200 years ago wrote the book The Origin of Species. He was the person who, just through observation, managed to decode the mechanism of how nature works. He started to understand and describe the process of evolution. And what's remarkable about Charles Darwin is he made this enormous sort of breakthrough of perception and understanding. But he only ever saw a very small part of the evidence. He only ever saw a small part of the picture. He didn't have a microscope. He wasn't able to see microbes and bacteria and other things that aren't naked visible to the naked eye. But he predicted that we would find them. And he told us what age of rocks we could expect to find them in. And he was correct. So there's something really quite extraordinary about that ability to observe and to extrapolate the whole picture, but from only seeing a smaller part, small part of the evidence. So I have a great respect for Charles Darwin. And I also think that he is greatly misunderstood and misinterpreted. And I'll try and expand on that a little bit, because people have tried to paraphrase, to sort of summarize what he said in quite simple terms. And actually what he said was more beautiful and more complicated than that. And we'll get to that. So here's a sort of our invitation to think is with through permaculture is, can we use observation to find a solution to problems? And in fact, we like to argue, Bill Mollison, the founder of permaculture, likes to argue that in many ways, a problem is the inverse of its own solution. If you can somehow flip something into reverse or to work in the other way, you can create something that not only can you solve the problem, but you can actually find natural processes in a way in which the problem reverses to become a solution, which then grows on itself. We can actually create beneficial spirals rather than sort of destructive spirals. By destructive spiral, I mean this. I mean, the more you cut down, let's say, forest or virgin woodland, the more you plow up a hill like that farmer did, the more you expose the soil, the more it's likely to wash away, which then amplifies the problem. So it gets worse and worse and worse. Is there a way in which we could make the smallest intervention, the smallest amount of work, so that we could flip that scenario, so that instead of it degrading and getting worse and worse and worse, it starts to build on itself and become better and better and better? So it's like the holy grail, the absolute thing that we're trying to achieve in permaculture is, can we make the smallest intervention, the smallest investment of work, time, resources, to create the biggest impact, to create the most significant effect? And we're challenged also to bring the third statement alive, is often the most elegant solutions, the smartest, cleverest solutions, they're so simple that they're invisible. You can't see that they're there. And maybe that's an insight into how the farmer in the first picture could make such a big error, is maybe it seemed to him that he took everything about that landscape for granted, didn't really understand the role the plants were making and the hedges were making and the trees were making to keep those soils stable. And so he failed to see what was there. We have a saying in Britain, say you can't see the wood for the trees, which is an interesting thought. Anyway, so this next diagram looks like a crazy, let's say spider's web, but it doesn't look like a spider's web. But it represents all of the life on Earth. We're going to take some time to think about this. So all life on Earth can be put into three categories. Okay, let's see. This is how biologists look at life on Earth. And we all know about what bacteria are, right? They're little unicellular organisms, which we can't see, but we know that they're there. And actually, so each branch of that tree, each branch represents a number of different species of bacteria. And whatever that it branches again, as that creates that suggests a divergence, another sort of subset of diversity of bacteria. So each one, if you think the length of the line and the number of branches, represents the number of species of bacteria that, as we know so far, exist on planet Earth. And it's about a third of all living things are invisible in the soil, in the air, on the surfaces that you can't see, but for sure they're doing very important things. Now you might associate bacteria with pathogens, with organisms that carry disease, and some bacteria do indeed cause disease, but it's about 0.1% of bacteria. 99.999% of bacteria are absolutely essential for the proper functioning of natural systems. And in fact, your gut has about 3 pounds of bacteria in it. And without them being there, you can't digest your food, because actually they're all part of that process of breaking down the organic matter that you eat and allowing that to then to break down into nutrients that your body can absorb. So a third of all life on Earth is bacteria, and it's invisible. And another third form and a weirder form of life, which they is summarized as the archaea. Now, many of these species are also unicellular. You can't see them. But many of them, they don't even live and breathe in the same environment as us. They can breathe carbon dioxide and they put out methane and they can eat sulfur and they can live in deep in the ocean bed of the floor where in sort of volcanic cracks and really live a very different kind of existence to anything that we could really imagine. They're, again, very, very important part of the diversity of species. And actually, if you look at the way specifically for the archaea, the top right is, there's a big split into two different types. And there's still an argument within biology is whether that's actually, they might actually be so different that they need another name, need to come up with another subset of organisms. But so far, what we've seen is that like two thirds of all diversity of life is single cell organisms that we can't see, but they are, if you like, they're part of what creates the conditions for life, creates the conditions for there to be soils and nutrient exchange, which and many other things, which then allow for the possibility of more complex organisms to exist as well. So the if we go to the bottom part of this diagram, we have a section called the eukarya. And eukaryotic organisms are organisms that have multiple cells. They have organs, they have structures, they might be able to move around or see or sense in a more complex way than the bacteria and archaea can. Many of the eukarya are still very, very small, microscopic, and we can't always see them. But they are the more interesting, more complex types of life on Earth, and the ones obviously that we are more closely related to in the evolutionary tree. Okay, now one of the ideas that Charles Darwin explored, which seems to have played out, which is that all life on Earth has a common origin. The very first life forms on Earth were very, very, very simple things that were really just created by chemicals flowing across a membrane, perhaps by arranged by heat, spin of the earth, which causes molecules to cluster together, which then in turn can start to perform certain very simple kinds of functions. Now, all of that stacks up over 4.5 billion years, if you can believe it, of evolution, to create more and more ever more complex organisms that are actually more and more interwoven with each other and organisms that live within organisms. Now, here's the thing that I really want to press on you is when we get right to the far tip of this diagram, we see fungi, plants, and animals. Well, those are the things that we're used to seeing and interacting with. And of all of the biodiversity on the planet, only about 1% of it is fungi, plants, and animals. So 99% of all of what there is, all the living things on the planet is we can't see, and we don't really think about them. But they are there, and they are a very important part of what makes everything else work. Now, you can see how closely we are on this biodiversity tree. Animals, obviously, we come under humans, Homo sapiens, we come under Animalia, we are animals. We share 99% of our genes with chimpanzees. 99% of the genetic material of our genes is the same as a chimpanzee. But this is the thing that really blows me away. And this is maybe helps you understand what this diagram is saying is we share 70% of our DNA with a fruit fly. We are 70% fruit fly, which would also come under the animals and in this very large grouping. And it's not that we look like fruit flies or behaves like fruit flies, but the key genes are the processes, the biological processes going on within your body about creating proteins and digesting food and fighting off disease. Well, actually, the fruit fly is doing all of that as well. So even to be a complex organism relatively simple to us, but actually a fly would be a very complex organism compared to, you know, going back down the family tree of the bacteria and archaea that preceded it. So this again is really speaks to this idea that we're all in this together. We're all part of this big interconnected system, you know, and the evolutionary tree is part of how we know that and how we understand that. I'm going to do a couple more slides and I think I'm going to take a break because this kind of is a big topic and I don't want to overload people. So I'm going to go to the next slide, which is it's a picture of a shallow sea. And you can see in there what look like rocks. And the caption, life is a chemical reaction. What we're seeing there isn't rocks. They're not the first life on Earth. Not the first organism on Earth on an evolutionary tree, but they've been around for 4 billion years. So they go, and the planet Earth's about 4.5 billion years old. I don't know, evolution, whatever, said about. So what are they? Well, there's a story behind this, and I want to unpack this story a little bit because it's very, very important. The 1950s, 1960s, some of the top scientists in the world working on the space program for NASA, for the space age, which obviously was beginning to really capture people's imagination back at that time. There was a very famous scientist at the time called James Lovelock, and he was asked by NASA to look at the other planets in the solar system and answer the question, is there life on Mars? Is there life on Venus? Is there life on other planets? And if so, how would we know? It's a good question to ask, isn't it? It's a very interesting question to ask. And the answer is, well, is it complicated? I don't know. But is the way that they did it was that they analyzed the light coming back from the planet that they were looking at. So you can imagine the light from the sun. So say you're looking at Mars in the night sky. The light that you're seeing is actually light from the sun. It's penetrated the atmosphere of Mars and then bounced off Mars and then come all the way to Earth down your telescope. So if you can then analyze that light, you can refract it through a glass prism. You can split the light into its constituent parts, red, orange, green, blue, indigo, violet, that's spectrum. And the spectrum of the light is distorted, it's misshapen, according to the gases of the atmosphere of the planet that it's passed through. So you can imagine if a light beam has bounced, gone through the Mars atmosphere, bounce off the surface of Mars to come out again, that somehow the shape of that light has been changed by the constituency of the atmosphere. Okay, that's what James Lovelock looked at. And so he could, just by analysing light, he could work out what was the constituency, what the atmosphere of the planet was made out of. So he asked this really fundamental question, is what would be the signature of life? How would we know from looking at the atmosphere that there would be life on that planet? And the answer he came up with was the presence of oxygen. And the reason why that is the case is that oxygen, as I think we kind of all kind of know, even if we haven't studied chemistry, is the most reactive of all the elements. So if oxygen comes near to iron, it binds to the iron and you get ferrous oxide rust. Oxygen comes near carbon and we have some kind of combustion and then we have carbon dioxide, or the way we breathe in oxygen and we breathe out carbon dioxide is it reacts with the things around it. Actually, the presence of oxygen allows us to burn things. If you think about it, you can't burn anything in a vacuum, or if you imagine in a in a charcoal kiln where there's no oxygen is the wood doesn't burn, does it? It just chars. So to have big complicated animals like us, human beings, elephants, or dinosaurs, or anything like that is, they need a lot of energy. So they need to be able to oxidize energy very quickly to, you know, to power their muscles. Okay. So in looking at the atmosphere of Mars and asking, can we see oxygen? Suddenly the question dawned on James Lovelock is, well, where does the oxygen on planet Earth come from? Because we've seen, because of this reality, because oxygen constantly reacts with things and then becomes something else, the only way for there to be oxygen present in the atmosphere is if it's being continually produced. So we know that the oxygen in our atmosphere largely comes from plants. Trees breathe in carbon dioxide. They hold on to the carbon to make more tree, and they release the oxygen. So that's where our oxygen came from. But at the beginning of the evolutionary timeline, there were no plants. We know that from looking at the geological record. So it then came the question is, well, so where did the original oxygen that allowed, you know, the evolution to happen, if you like? Otherwise, we'd still be at the unicellular stage. What I'm saying is we might have a few bacteria or these strange archaea, but we certainly wouldn't have whales or trees here without there being oxygen. So where did it come from? So they looked, and they looked, and they looked, and they looked, and they found these organisms, these structures, that look a bit like coral reefs, actually. And what it is, it's a unicellular organism. It's called a stromatolite. And let's say they first occurred about 3.7 billion years ago, something like that. And it was the first organism that could grab, and at that time, the atmosphere of planet Earth was predominantly carbon dioxide. And these organisms could grab hold of the carbon dioxide, use the carbon to help build their structure, calcium carbonate, like shells and coral and limestones. And it would use that, use the carbon in its structure, and then it didn't need the oxygen, so it'd release it. And then slowly, slowly, and at this time, 3.5 billion years ago, the planet Earth was covered with lots of shallow, warm seas. And these seas were full of these things called stromatolites. And we can see fossilized ones. We've seen ones being compressed by layers of rock, and they've sort of been preserved, and we can date them, so we know that that's the case. But amazingly, there's still stromatolites. There's still places where they still exist. And these ones are off the coast of Western Australia. It's not my photo. I got it from a library photo, but it's for real. So this was the astounding realization that James Lovelock had through this research, was that the conditions for life, the conditions that we need to create life on Earth, were themselves created by life on Earth. Whoa! Just think about that. The oxygen that we breathe was created by other organisms, and then that enabled us to be able to evolve more complicated organisms that then drove that oxygen and carbon cycle so that slowly the world could evolve and become more complicated. Now, I don't want to get into religion and theology and all of that sort of stuff. I know that some people have this sort of idea that God created the world. I think that's a beautiful way of looking at it. But permaculture tells us this, is that everything's constantly changing. So whatever it was that God created, if you like, the spark of creation, the beginning of this process of evolution, is everything that's happened since has happened by this flow of natural forces and energies. And if there was a creator of the universe, that would be the smartest way to create it. Would be to, if you like, put the ingredients, the constituents there, and then allow just over time, let that to play out and life evolve and form. And it's, as we know, constantly changing because it's been shaped and formed by these processes. So that's the end of part one of this lecture. I'm going to take a break, and then we're going to pick up and go into this go much more deeply. So I hope you've enjoyed that. and we've got a lot to think about. So please perhaps review some of this and think about what it really means. Thanks for listening.